Okay, so the theme of precious human rebirth, of course, one of the classic Buddhist themes. And I think that it is... it's interesting, or it's important to note that, because Buddhism sometimes has a reputation for being a bit depressing. And sometimes that the Buddha, of course, was always going on about suffering. And he's always like suffering this and suffering that. And people think, oh, that's a bit depressing. So, and the Buddha's always like, oh, you're going to die. Deal with it. But there's a difference between being depressing and being negative about things and just acknowledging the reality of the world. So the Buddha would always say, well, that's just how it is, which, I don't know, somehow makes it even more depressing, maybe. But anyway. But it's also important to acknowledge that the Buddha had a balance of teachings, and he would teach in different ways and teach in different respects. And the point of saying that there is suffering in life, and it's the point of saying that we're facing our mortality, is not so we can get depressed about it. The point is so that we can live. The point is so that we can live better, because we understand and we appreciate what our life is and what we can do about it. And especially, most of all, the fact that we can practice Dhamma. And what that means is that we are conscious beings able to reflect on our lives and able to make choices about how we want to live them. And I'm not sure that any other species or any other species that we know of can really do that, not in the way that we can anyway. And when you think about it, then you begin to realize that there are in fact so many blessings about being human. And I'll just list a few of them. There's too many to even go through, but I'll just list a few of them. Number one, we have coffee. Okay? I mean, I rest my case. And... number two, we have all of these comforts that we live with, that we take for granted. Yeah? Clothes. Right? I mean, they say clothes maketh the man, which is very true, because if, I don't know if you ever noticed, but like naked people have very little influence in society. Nobody takes you seriously if you're naked, right? But animals walk around naked all the time, you know, unless humans dress them up. So we have clothes, we have food, right? My goodness, all the effort that we put into creating all this incredibly delicious food, right? And what animals have to eat, right? You just go and just chomp some grass off the lawn, or you, whatever. It's not very appetizing. I mean, they don't seem to mind. But once you kind of got used to human food, it's hard to imagine going back, right? What else do we have? We've got cars, which are very cool, right? You can drive around fast and get places. You've got houses, right? Think about this building that we're in now. Yeah, it's what, 33, 35 degrees outside. And here we are, all nice and cool. This is actually one of this is one of the foundational human technologies. One of the basic human technologies was to be able to create our own environments, our mini climates. Yeah? So with the cavemen, when they spread across Europe, figured out how to light fire. So you can have a cave, you can light a fire, and you can keep yourself warm in the cold. You can shelter in the cave when it's hot and light a fire to keep yourself cool. And that ability to create microclimates and take them with you, right, is one of the foundational aspects of human culture. And I should just mention also, I mentioned before about clothes, and I'm, you know, kind of half joking, but also cloth and clothes are also one of the foundational human technologies. And recent archaeology seems to suggest more and more that the development, the invention of the spindle and being able to weave cloth was in fact the one of the foundational aspects of human technology. Like the spindle was the invention of the wheel. So the spindle came before the wheel did. And the ability to make cloth, again, to control your environment, to be able to stay in different kinds of places and get the kinds of shelter and comfort that you couldn't otherwise, was one of the fundamental things that meant that human beings were able to adapt to different environments, travel across the world, shelter from the sun, shelter from the wind and the rain, and be able to spread across the world. So these are all some of the good aspects of being human. What others are there? Well, we have culture, right? We have culture. We have great literature. We have songs. We have paintings. We have movies. We have artworks of all kinds. We have, and again, that goes back very, very far in human history. You know, you go back and look in the caves in France that go back tens of thousands of years, and you see how incredibly detailed and beautiful the drawings are. And I look at that and I think, like, there's no way that I could possibly draw a bison that would look as good as that. Much less in the back of a cave, way underground in the dark. So human culture has always been very remarkable and something which is quite unique. But we also have language. Right? Language is another incredible thing that humans have invented. Of course, you know, all of these things, you can see that, that different kind of animals will have them to maybe some degree or some, you know, a bit. But, you know, it's hard to make like a single hard and fast distinction and say this is something that humans have that animals don't have. Right? But on the whole, if you look at all of these things, humans have them to a much more developed degree and much more refined way than animals do. And so language is quite incredible, you know, and after many years we've managed to teach animals maybe a few words or to just say a few sayings or something like that. But humans, we just pick up language and can use it to communicate all of these incredibly complex and sophisticated ideas without even really thinking about it. And the mastery of language by human infants is one of the most remarkable achievements that anyone does. It's really incredible. And I haven't kept up with the studies in developmental psychology, but I know that Noam Chomsky believed that the acquisition of language was so incomprehensible that he believed that that babies are born essentially already having an innate knowledge of language, which he ascribed, I believe, to genetics. Perhaps, as a Buddhist, we might ascribe it to past lives. Who knows? But he said, but the point was that we learn language too quickly, and we can't explain how it's possible to pick up language so quickly. So, because of language, we can then have ideas, philosophies, and values, and moralities, and we can communicate those and share those. And again, you know, we can see that those things are things that are found in the animal realm. Certainly morality is found. And there's lots of instances and lots of ideas where you can see animals will have like a sense of doing the right thing. You know, and there's lots of very warm and fuzzy YouTube videos of different kind of animals helping each other out in the wild that you might not think that they would. And showing like even just sort of simple things, like when I go up to see my father. Usually I take the chance to go for a walk down the beach, and in Coffs Harbour, the surfers are out there, and they're always surfing with the dolphins. And it's amazing to me. I find it just so amazing to see that the dolphins and the surfers just enjoying the waves together. And you see this thing that playfulness is something which is very common across the species. Okay, so these are some of the things which we have in the human realm, which are very precious. We've also developed ways another thing which I think is important to bear in mind, that it's very precious in the human realm, and but also quite fragile, is we've developed, how do I put this, like cultural structures or cultural entities which are larger than ourselves. So a feeling of belonging to something which is larger than ourselves. And that might be something simple like a football team or like the alumni of a college or something like that. And you feel like you belong to your class with your classmates or something like that. But it can also mean like a religion. It can mean like a nation, right? A people. And you can feel a sort of sense of shared values and so on. Now, I think it's important to acknowledge this because that sense of shared identity and shared belonging can and often is a source of conflict. But it doesn't have to be. Right? The idea that you belong to a group that's bigger than yourself actually is inherently good. Right? It inherently lifts you out of your purely selfish ideas, and it means you have a sense of being, you know, I'm here, I'm born in Australia, I feel like a sense of belonging to Australia. Yeah? And I feel a kind of sense of identity if I see, you know, Vegemite. Then I think, ah, yes, it makes me happy. Even if I never eat Vegemite, right? It still makes me happy. But I also have a sense of identity as a Buddhist. And so I have a sense of, like, a feeling of connection and empathy when I see Buddhists in other nations and have some understanding of what they're going through. And this also is good. And now, usually there's no conflict between those two things except, you know, when it comes to playing cricket. In which case you've got to take a side. But but that idea that you can, that as humans, that through our human culture, like we develop its beliefs and symbols and ideas and ideologies that will lift us out of ourselves and give us a sense of belonging to something greater than ourselves, that also I think is very human, right? I don't think we really find that in animals. I mean, animals, they maybe like feel like a sense of belonging to a family, or maybe like a tribe or a herd that they belong to, but for humans it's much more abstract, you know, it's much more complex. And of course, you know, if we take that even further, then we have a sense of belonging to humanity, right? And even more than that, we have a sense of belonging to life. Right? We feel that we are here as part of everything else. And so our humanity and that preciousness of our humanity should not be a matter for conceit. Right? The fact that humans have all of these things doesn't mean that we're better than everything else. We're just different, maybe more evolved, maybe, you know, we're in this kind of state. But the Buddha said that in countless lives we get reborn as kangaroos. Well, the Buddha didn't actually say kangaroos, but kangaroos and cows and fish and sheep and all of those things. And we get reborn of those things. We've been those things in the past, and who knows, we may be again in the future. So just for this period of time, then we have this human rebirth. And we have this chance to make choices. And we have that chance to make choices that matter. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. So let's to sort of think this thing through and to think about how valuable this is. Let's look at it, get a sense of proportion. Now, let's work in space to start with. So here we are, sitting. The Buddha said that the origin and ending of the world was in this fathom-length body. So this is our human scale. This is where we are at, this body, from head to toe. This is where we breathe, it's where we live, it's where we walk, it's where we eat, and it's where our life is played out at. Inside of our body, there are many other creatures that live inside us, just as we live inside the world. And we like to imagine that we're sentient and that those creatures are not. Now, is that true? I don't know. I don't have any particular theories about it, but if it isn't, it's kind of worrying, isn't it, right? Because then you take some antibiotics and then you're doing some very serious damage. But the being creatures inside of ourselves, their world is happening on a tiny scale compared to us. And in that tiny scale, just a few cells or whatever, then they are born, live their lives, and die. Just as we, at our scale, are born and live our lives and die. And these days, of course, all of our lives have been radically changed by the COVID virus. We're all sitting here with our chairs nicely socially distanced. We've all got our masks and all of these things. And we've all come out of a year of this quarantine and social distancing and everything, which are all these kind of words and ideas that we never even thought of before. And that's all because of this tiny little creature that lives inside us. Or maybe it does, right? If we've got the virus and that creature lives inside us. That's it. That's all. And the COVID, and I've said this before, but it's really important to keep on remembering this. The COVID is not our enemy. COVID is just a life form who wants to live. And we were the ones that went into its home and chopped down its trees and killed its habitat and killed probably the bats that it originated from, took them into market or experimented on them or whatever we did. Somehow, we forced them out of their own home, into our home, into our fathom-length body. And they were very happy with that. COVID's like, much better than bats. This is big and fat and juicy. Yum. And they can spread, right? Wow. Very successful, in fact. The COVID-19 is a very successful virus, and we should be taking notes, right? Maybe we shouldn't be spending too much time trying to eradicate it and with more time trying to learn from it. Like, how was it so successful? So inside of our own body, there are countless bacteria and viruses and all of these kinds of things that are living and dying all the time. And they say that we have more non-human DNA than human DNA inside us. Those viruses and those bacteria, of course, happening even within them, there's so much complexity, so much structure, so much detail. And you can go even within them, and those, they're made up of all of these chemicals and compounds. And all of life that we know it is made up of carbon compounds, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, bits of trace elements. And they are bound together in proteins and fats and all of these different kinds of very complex chemical compounds that make up all life. And that does all of these very fancy things, like copying information and storing it and moving energy around from one place to another and all of this stuff that's going on in our cells all of the time. And those chemicals, those chemical molecules that's going on happening in a water solution, is really biologically speaking, is basically the same as the ocean. So basically the water is similar pH, similar makeup, similar chemicals to what you find in the ocean. So we grew up in the ocean or grew up in water, evolved in water, and we still carry it around with us. So we're like a little piece of the ocean that grew a skin around it. And so but those chemicals and so on, these are all made up of atoms. Well, atoms, again, are very fascinating things because they have their own intricate and detailed structure, which the human mind has been able to discern and to uncover. Protons and neutrons, electrons and things. I mean, we learned at school, we learned this kind of planetary model of the atom with the protons and neutrons in the middle and then electrons whirling around the outside. Of course, is from modern physics point of view, is not really a very accurate model, but it's still sort of one way of thinking about it. But from a modern perspective of modern physics, electrons don't so much orbit around the central nucleus, but they more or less inhabit this sort of, they're more like a smear of probability, which sort of manifests as an energy around the nucleus. And even those subatomic particles themselves are made up at a more fundamental level as quarks and all of these other weird names that I forget. And then at even more fundamental, maybe strings. But even there, we're not quite sure because that's where our instruments fail us. And we keep on building bigger particle accelerators and colliders to look into this thing at a more and more detailed level. But there comes a point where, so far, we haven't been able to see beyond. There's a horizon to our knowledge. We go down further and further and further, and at that point, theory and observation fail us. And we really just have informed speculation at that point. Maybe maybe there'll be a breakthrough and we'll go further to another level, but that's about where we're at now. So that's when we take the scale downwards, inwards, but we also can take the scale upwards from ourselves. We, as we're sitting here, we are, like I said, we are like little blobs of water that grew skin around ourselves, and that skin is porous. So we are not self-contained entities. We like to think we are, right? We have this idea of an I or a self, and we say, I am this thing here. I am this. I am Sujata. But that's only ever an approximation. And this is one of the problems with the idea of a self or identity that the Buddha talked about. Like we have this idea of that I am this self, I am this Sujata, but actually it's not that simple because the past Sujata was different than the present Sujata, and the future Sujata will be different again. But somehow we use the same name. But even as we're sitting here, where do I actually start and where do I end? We breathe in. And every person here, as we're sitting, is breathing in. We breathe in oxygen and we breathe out carbon dioxide. Breathing in oxygen, breathing out carbon dioxide. And so, since we've been here for now an hour, we've all breathed in each other. So some of the air which has been in your lungs, I have breathed in. And some of the air which has been in my lungs, you have breathed in. And so part of me is in you and part of you is in me. So which one's which? Who is who? And right as we're doing this now, we're doing it. Our mouth is interchanging, moisture is being shed, sweat's coming out from our body. Right? So the actual boundaries around ourselves are porous. And notice how this is always kind of a bit disturbing, right? Whenever the boundaries around ourself or our body become ruptured, we get distressed. Like if you get a cut, you start to bleed, right? It's quite distressing. I mean, apart from the fact that it might hurt or whatever, but it's just kind of a bit freaky to see yourself like that. Yeah. And so we have this inner idea of ourself, which we imagine as a whole, which is permanent, but actually is impermanent and is changing, and is always a bit fuzzy at the edges. So we're kind of leaking out into the world around us, and the world around is leaking into us. And so we are part of the air, we're part of the land, we're part of the water, we're part of the trees, we're part of all of the different aspects of the natural world. And that world is also in us. We've been created from it, and that also the artificial world. So what, as human beings, we've taken this simple idea, right? The first caveman thought, right, hey, we can light a fire, right? We can light a fire and keep warm in the winter. Great idea. And not only can we do that, we can then, oh, this thing, we can get these fibers and you can spin them and weave them into a cloth. I mean, even the idea of doing that, it seems so much hard work, right? So complicated, but sitting around the fireplace, I guess you didn't have too much else to do. So you sit around the fireplace, weaving. And then we can carry these inner environments inside our clothes. We carry our own little environment. So this simple idea that we can modify and change our environment for our own comfort, we've maybe taken it a little bit too far. Right? We then started building houses and we started making... Okay, bye-bye. Started making fields and crops so that we could enjoy food all year round, store up food. And now look at where we are. Now we live in these worlds made of concrete and steel. And when we see some water or a forest or a tree, we think, how lovely. It's so nice. It's amazing. It really is amazing when you think about it in the human realm, how much effort we put into making things that are so ugly. Really. Drive around the streets of Sydney. I mean, I love Sydney. Okay, and we have the Opera House. But we have a lot of things that are not the Opera House as well. And so we've created this world. And then, of course, that has a cost, you know. Climate change, pollution. And again, that's inside us. That's not something, because we exist in this fuzzy way, we're connected with everything else, inside us is microplastics. That's part of you. You are part of this industrial process of extracting fossil fuels, refining it, turning it into plastic, shipping it around the world into all kinds of things, using it once, throwing it away, getting discarded, disintegrating, getting into the water, getting into the air, and then somehow it gets back inside you. And those particles began life as maybe trees millions of years ago. Yeah, became fossilized. And we're a part of that. And climate change also. It's not just something which happens outside. It's not just a scientific reality that scientists go and study. It's our life. You know, we walk around, you know, today just walked from Harris Park down here. It's a little bit warm today. I said it was 33 degrees when I was coming. And if you're brought up in Australia, there's no great surprise to find, you know, a hot day is 33 degrees. But it's been hotter, right? Sometimes we've been up to like 43 degrees, 10 degrees hotter than that. The hottest in this area has been 47, 48 degrees, 15 degrees hotter. So if you go out today and you think it's hot, it's been 15 degrees hotter than that. Yeah, a few times in the last few years. In years to come, the global climate keeps on getting hotter. We'll see a 50 degree temperature in Sydney before too long. Give us a few years. Maybe 53, maybe 55. A few decades down the track. I've never been in a temperature that hot. The hottest I've ever been was either in Sydney a few years ago, it was 47. Or there was one day when we were driving across the Nullarbor, driving across the Australian desert. I don't know how hot it was. I just know that we got out of the bus and everybody almost just like fell over in the middle of the day. It was incredibly hot. We just staggered a few metres from the bus to the roadhouse. I'm like, oh, we've survived. So I don't know how hot that was. It certainly would have been in the high 40s. So it's really hot. Yeah, it's really hot. And this is part of the world which we have made and we have shaped. So this world which exists around us is not something which exists independently from us. It's something that we exist together with, that influences and conditions us, and we influence and condition it. And this is our planet. And so if you look around our planet, you see our planet is a very kind of strange thing. You know, we have, most of it is covered in water. So then they have the land bits, and the land bits, sometimes some of it's desert, some of it's forest, some of it's farmland, and so on. And then we decide that we want to carve it up and put straight lines on it and say, this bit is mine and that bit is yours. And then we'll fight about it. It's very strange. Why do we do that? I don't know. It's very kind of odd. And this planet, everything that we've seen, like if we see it from our human perspective, and you know, when we walk around, what we see is maybe the grass under our feet or the path under our feet. We see the walls, we see the houses, we see the trees, we see the things that's happening at our level or a bit bigger or a bit smaller. But do we ever stop to think that, like, our life is actually lived within this very, very narrow strip around the earth? Just a few meters either way. And life goes a few meters under the ground. Different kind of fungi and bacteria and so on. Not very far down. I don't know how far it goes, but not that far. And then life goes up a few meters into the air. The tallest trees, you know, a few tens of meters or something like that. And then some birds and, I guess some bacteria or whatever are up higher than that. But not that far. Maybe a kilometer or two at the most. And that's it. That's that thin film of life. It's like, you think of it like the planet is, you know, it's like a bowling ball that's got like a bit of mold on the surface of it. That's it. That's our life. That's not our life. That's life. There's a bit of mold on the surface of a bowling ball. And humanity's in the process of polishing the bowling ball and effectively removing what is there. And then if we look at the bigger perspective than the planet, we go out into space. Now, and I'm sure, and most of you, probably all of you know that I'm a huge science fiction geek. Space is very cool, okay? Well, stories about space are very cool. Space itself is kind of horrifying. And when you grow up in watching science fiction, as I did and reading science fiction in the 70s and the 80s, then, you know, you see things like Star Trek, which is like, you know, very exciting, and you get to explore all these different worlds and meet all these different people, and there's this sense of adventure about it. Star Wars, also kind of fun, you know, adventurous, and you get to, like, you know, all of these, you know, you get to move through space at improbable speeds and discover all these incredible worlds and so on. But probably a more realistic depiction of space was Alien, which you had the tagline, in space no one can hear you scream. And Alien was about capturing that sense of literally what is alien about space. Right? Space is terrifying, actually. Like, I know that it's kind of fun in the movies, but it's actually terrifying. There's nothing there. Like, it's really hard to describe how much nothing is in space. It's like so much nothing. It's just unbelievable. And the distance between one planet, like our planet and Mars, yeah. Or even our planet and the moon. Like, we've now flown to the moon. I mean, can you imagine? We've gone to the moon, but the moon is just like The moon is like visiting, in a galactic scale, visiting the moon, it's a bit like going to the dunny, right? I mean, it's just like a walk down the backyard, right? And it may feel like a big adventure if it's late at night and you have to walk down to the backyard to your dunny, but in the scheme of things, it's not all that far, right? And Mars is like far, much greater distance than the moon, right? We've been to Mars a few times, yeah? And getting to Mars, you know, with the current technology is not all that difficult. And I've mentioned this before, but, you know, just to celebrate, one of the greatest achievements was of modern space travel was the Indian Space Agency, who sent an exploratory ship to Mars a number of years ago. They called it the Chandrayaan, is that right? Anyway. And one of my favorite photos of all time is a photo of the Indian Space Agency with the space controllers and all of the engineers who had made this possible at the moment when they succeeded. And it was all of these Indian women in saris. And they're all jumping up and down and hugging each other and laughing when their mission was successful. And they went to Mars on a budget of about $70 million. Can you imagine? That's half as much as it costs Hollywood to make a movie about going to Mars. Right. So we can do that. Mars, Venus, we can get to. Right? And that's a long way. Yeah, it's a long way. But that's like nothing. Right? When you go to the next star system, it's light years away. Light years. Can you imagine? Do you even know what a light year is? The distance it takes, the distance light can travel in a year. I mean, are you crazy? How far is that? How far is a light year? I mean, light is instantaneous for all intents and purposes, right? I mean, we've never seen light taking, when you switch the light on there, it doesn't like come here. No, it's really fast. It's like incredibly fast. So the distance that light travels in a year is the fastest distance that's possible in the universe. The speed of light is the speed that you go to when there is no speed limit. That's the speed limit of the universe. And it still takes years to get to the nearest star system, Alpha Centauri. It's a long way, and between here and there, like, before I was a monk, I was a musician. And my band used to tour around Australia. And when we were touring around Australia, you know, we would drive across the desert. And I've done this a number of times, right, driving across from Perth to the eastern states. And there's a lot of nothing there. And if you've never driven it, it's worthwhile just seeing, because I remember one time I was driving and I was there with Peggy, the singer, and we were in the car and we were just driving across and we're like, okay, it's getting a bit late now, we should pull over and, you know, have a rest. And we're just driving and we're like, there's nowhere to pull over. It's not like a tree or a bend in the road or a sign or a rock or anything like that. We just sort of we just felt weird. You couldn't just pull over at the side of the road and there's nothing there. You had to pull over at something, you know, wait for the next 100 kilometres, and then the road sort of bends like that. So, okay, they're good enough, that's a landmark. we can pull over here, there's a nice little rest stop. There's a lot of nothing out there. Uh-huh. And many of you came, or some of you came with us to the retreat in Central Australia last year. And again, just that feeling and that knowledge that you said that there's a huge amount of emptiness. But that's nothing compared to the emptiness in space. And the Buddha had all of these kind of great similes and these metaphors to try to convey these kinds of sizes and these kinds of distances. But one of the most intriguing passages in the suttas is where it talks about these creatures that are born in the abysmal vortices of interstellar space. Right? So somehow there are these creatures, these sentient beings of some kind, that are born out there. So this isn't talking about like aliens who are living on planets like us. Okay. So in Buddhism, we've never had a problem with the idea of aliens. All right. Aliens are fine, and we've always assumed that there's countless world systems, and that there's countless sentient beings out in those world systems. That's fine. That's not a problem for us. But this is talking about beings living in interstellar space or intergalactic space. Be kind of lonely out there. You'd be very, very, very lonely. So how is this possible? How is it possible for beings or for creatures to live in intergalactic space? I mean, you would think from modern science it's impossible, because how can you evolve in that kind of situation, right? How is it possible to live out there? Well, science does actually have an explanation for that. I don't know if you want to hear it, but it does have an explanation, and the explanation is Boltzmann brains. Anyone know what Boltzmann brains are? Boltzmann brains are very cool. Okay, I'll tell you what Boltzmann brains are, right? Boltzmann brains, so in quantum theory, we've now gone out to the universe. It's huge, the whole size, and there's nothing there. There's just space, right? But it's incomprehensibly large. And if we take it now back to the smallest scale, or the quantum level, we take it back down through our level, remember, we're here at this fathom-length body, we're in the middle of this, and then we come back to the smallest level, to the particle, right? Now, according to quantum theory, that at the smallest possible level, particles are popping into existence and popping out of existence randomly. Now, to interpret this and understand this is difficult, and it's one of the problems of quantum theory, but that's the basic idea. So you imagine that the fundamental structure of space-time is like a soda that is bubbling, and particles are like popping in and out of existence. All right, and these are very just simple particles, like a quark or something like that. Right? But if two particles can pop into existence and out of existence, if one particle can pop into existence and out of existence, then two can. Right? It's just probability. Right? One's going to go boom and then disappear. So sooner or later, two of them are going to go boom next to each other. Right? And then sooner or later, you're going to have three that will go boom next to each other. Makes sense, right? Then you're going to have four. Now, these things become very unlikely, right? To have one particle that come into existence is unlikely. To have two is very unlikely. To have three is incredibly unlikely. To have four is unbelievably unlikely. But it's still possible. And in fact, because the universe is so big, it happens all the time. And if you can have four particles, you can have five or six, or even an entire brain that can pop spontaneously into existence by the laws of quantum physics and just exist. This is what they call a Boltzmann brain. If you don't believe me, you can look it up on Wikipedia. Okay, it's a real thing. So Boltzmann brains can pop spontaneously into existence. Now, the probability of that happening is incredibly small. It's like unbelievably, ridiculously low probability of it happening. And yet the universe is so big that it probably does happen. And depending on how you run the numbers, it may be the case that Boltzmann brains, there's more Boltzmann brains than there are human brains. So the normal sentient life form in the universe may in fact be spontaneously generated beings who just exist in the middle of space, look around themselves and say, "What the?" Which again is a reminder of the precious human life, because here we have all of these things and we're not like floating around in space wondering what's going on. So leaving aside even these more exotic forms of life like the Boltzmann brains, and we have the other worlds, we have a possibility of alien life living on those other worlds. And I hope that there is, right? But one of the things that's interesting, because of course now, you know, scientists have been searching for alien life forms for many decades now. And we have the quite advanced research programs, the SETI program and others, which are constantly scanning the heavens looking for signs of life. And of course, you know, human beings we're not shy, right? I mean, we're lighting up our cities. We're broadcasting all of our television and all of these kinds of things constantly. So you'd think that somebody out there would be able to see us, right? I don't know if it's a good idea for them to see us, but anyway, you'd think they'd be able to see us. And then, so if life on other planets is somewhat similar to us, then, you know, we imagine that we also could see them. We could maybe see these kind of radiographic signatures and others which give us signs of life on other planets. But we can't. So far, we haven't actually found any signs of life. And this is what they call the Fermi paradox. And so the Fermi paradox is simply the question is, where is everyone? And like if you know, it doesn't seem that unlikely that life can evolve, and then if life involves intelligent life, then how come we can't see other civilizations? Why isn't the universe full of life? And it's a quite a profound question, and there's a lot of research and a lot of philosophy that's gone on around this question, but it is an interesting point. I mean, it could be just a matter of probability, just statistics. It could be just the universe is too big. It might not actually have a very profound answer. But one of the more obvious answers to the Fermi paradox is also perhaps one of the most depressing ones, which is simply that technological societies don't last. Because we like blow everything up, yeah, or we use up all the resources, yeah. And what we see around us right now is we see a society that is going incredibly fast, that is pushing incredibly fast, fueled by desire and oil. Right, oil and fossil fuels give us the means. The physical means to get what we want. Bigger cars, bigger houses, all of these things that we want, right? We always wanted those things, or at least had the potential to want those things, but now we can actually get them, and we can get them because of the energy that we get primarily from fossil fuels. And then that's having all of these effects in terms of climate change, in terms of extinction of species, in terms of pollution, and all of those things, together with all of the social pressures that come with those things. And one theory is that, yeah, that's what happens. Species, if they develop a technological society, burn out. They burn brightly for a short time, and then they use up all their resources, destroy their environment, and then they're gone. That's why we can't see anyone. Now, maybe that's not true. Like I said, this is purely speculation. Maybe it's not true, but it's kind of sobering, though, isn't it? Yeah? It's kind of sobering. That's the reason why all of the billions and trillions of other planets that could support life around the universe, but they're either societies that are like pre-industrial, right? So it's not saying that there can't be intelligent life in other planets, but it's saying that it wouldn't be industrial society. Right? It's not human society or sentient society, which is necessarily short-lived, it's industrial society. Right? So if you're living a more content lifestyle, you know, people have lived for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, living in a more content way together with nature. And it's true, you don't get to have all of the fancy stuff, and you have to miss out on your coffee. But it's more so, that's what sustainable means. So we don't know. We don't know what our future will be, but it certainly is cause for concern. So then that... Now, we've gone out from here out to the stars and then the galaxies, and like even in between the galaxies, even the space is more, and then it goes further and until the universe, until you reach the ends of the universe. And at the furthest reaches of the universe, you have like quasars and these things that are exotic bodies and energies and things that we don't really understand. Much of the universe is made of dark matter and dark energy, which are really just words that physicists use to say we don't know in a cool way. And that's what's out there. And, you know, the Buddha said, is the universe finite or infinite? Well, we can never know. This is one of the questions that the Buddha said is an unanswerable question, and physicists today still don't know that. The Buddha said, does the universe have a beginning and an end? He said, this is an unknowable question, and physicists today still don't know that. And these are problems that the further you take your knowledge, the closer to the horizon that you get, there's another horizon. And there's always something more that you don't know. And people sometimes think that they will find the answer. You'll find like the smallest possible particle, or you'll find the furthest possible distance. But remember Rohitasa, the first astronaut who traveled, was an asura who traveled from across the galaxies. And he traveled faster and further than any other being. And yet, even after exploring for such a long time and traveling so fast, he could never find the end of the world. And the Buddha has said to him, the end of the world is in here. This is where you find the beginning of the world. The end of the world. This is where your life is lived out, in this fathom-length body. And so that distance over space is also a distance in time. And the same thing, if we go back in time, our culture here in Australia, we have a very short-lived culture, a couple of hundred years. Aboriginal culture goes back maybe 50, 60,000 years. Humanity is around somewhat before then, and then the progenitors of humanity before that. Life, back some millions of years. So again, if you see that spectrum of time, everything that surrounds us, everything that we take as normal, like video cameras and mobile phones, internet, YouTube, these are a very, very short span of existence in the scheme of things. Human life is a little bit longer, life a little bit longer itself, but the universe is countless billions of years old. And I, you know, personally, I think that we should be cautious about drawing too much of a direct correlation between the Buddha's statements about cosmology in the suttas and what we see in modern cosmology today. Because the Buddha often was speaking in quite metaphorical terms, and he wasn't speaking like, you know, when he measured time, he would say, well, the time is like, imagine how long it would take for the Himalayas to wear down, for example, right? So he's not measuring it in terms of a number of years and so on. And so it wasn't sort of expressed in the same precise scientific terms. But nevertheless, it is rather extraordinary that if you measure the lifespan of the aeon as expressed in the suttas, it is more or less exactly the same as the lifespan of the universe as estimated by modern cosmology. And that's kind of interesting. We had a discussion at Bodhinyana with this a few years ago with a physicist who was a fellow student of Ajahn Brahm's at Cambridge. And Ajahn Brahm went on to become a monk, of course, and he stayed on. He was a colleague of Stephen Hawking's. And Ajahn Brahm knew him from all that time ago. And he came to Bodhinyana to visit Ajahn Brahm and was talking with the monks. And we talked to him about these things. And honestly, I can't recall all the details now. But Brahmali sort of shared with him his estimate of the age of an aeon, according to Buddhism. And I think it was something like 30 billion years or something like that, and the estimate of the life of the universe was something like 16 billion. And what he said was that actually now they're just re-estimating the life of the universe and it's more likely to be 30 billion. So the... again, I don't know, maybe they'll re-estimate it again. I want to say that this is... thing, but it's extraordinary that it's even in the same, you know, ballpark, right? So certainly that idea of that scale of the universe and that scale of time and multiple universes. So that's just one and countless eons. The Buddha recollected back, 91 eons or something like that, but it just keeps on going. And so that scale, the space and the time, and in that scale is just us. The universe doesn't care about us. sorry to say. Gone on happily without us for a long time, and it will go a long time. And we're not going to change that. But our life is lived out here. And we live in these very extraordinary times. And we have these extraordinary capacities and extraordinary abilities. And of all the extraordinary abilities that we have, perhaps the most extraordinary is our ability to choose. Our ability to change, to reflect on who we are, where we are, what is our purpose, and to make a better choice. And we're not fixed in what we do. We're not limited by what others have told us, or by what our culture says, or by what our politicians say, or by what our neighbours say, or our family says, or anything like that. We can choose. And we can choose to do something better. And the most meaningful choice that we as humans can make is a very, very simple one. When there is a choice to do good or to do bad, we can choose to do good. That's it. That's the most significant choice that you can make in your life. We have a choice to do good or to do bad, and we can choose to do good. Now, can we determine that we're going to have a good life? That we're going to live for so many years, or that we're going to have a flourishing family, or that we're going to be successful in our career, or can we? No, we can't choose those things. They're just probabilities. They depend on so many external factors. But a good life is not defined by any of those things. A good life is defined by somebody who chooses to do good. That's all. And one day, you will come to the end of your life. And according to the Buddhist idea of rebirth, that won't be the end for you. Now, I should mention, I've been talking about the expansion of the cosmos and time and back and forth and all of those things. But that's only the beginning. Because in Buddhism, it's not just all of those things in time and space, but there's also like multiple dimensions within that and all of these different realms of rebirth, right? So that's like a kind of another sort of axis. You know, there's time and space, but then there's all these other dimensions. We don't even really kind of understand from a physical point of view about these things, but the basic idea is that our consciousness is linked not just with sentient beings and creatures on the earth, not just with other humans, not just with other sentient beings and creatures, not just with even other creatures, aliens on other planets, or even Boltzmann brains, okay? We're not just linked with all of those things, but also with beings in other dimensions that we can't even see. It's very big and complicated. And when we die, we could go anywhere in that. We can get reborn as a turtle. We can get reborn as a Boltzmann brain. We could get reborn as the alien overlord of a star system. If we're reading too much science fiction, then we're going to be getting reborn there. We could be reborn in so many of these exotic places. One of the things that's interesting, though, if you look at potentials for rebirth is one thing, but if you look at actual rebirth stories, most of the stories of actual rebirth people tend to remember lives that were kind of similar to their own life. Right? So life in their own village or their own family, in their own district. It kind of makes sense because your consciousness tends to be attached to the things that you know. Right? So a lot of the time we would get reborn in that way. One of the studies that I saw about rebirth many years ago that I found one of the most convincing was a study done of hypnosis of children. And they had recollected details of past lives. But the thing that was really convincing about this was done over a survey of several hundred kids. One of the things that was really convincing about it was that the details they gave were very historically accurate. So in their past lives, they weren't eating candy and McDonald's. They were eating porridge and dry bread. Not the kind of thing that a kid would just make up. And one of the most specific details that they said was that they identified that they were eating with a two-pronged fork. Yeah? A little historical detail. Nobody knows this, right? But, you know, we never see two-pronged forks now. You don't eat with two-pronged forks. But historically, this was done. This study was done in Europe, and historically in Europe, two-pronged forks were the norm during the Middle Ages. I can't remember the exact years, and then gradually they developed three- and four-pronged forks. So the idea that in a certain period of time that you'd be eating with a two-pronged pork or a two-pronged fork, either way, either one works. So it's historically very precise little detail and something that you wouldn't expect kids to know. And so this idea that we're connected with lives in the past and lives in the future, we're connected with each other. The Buddha said it's not easy to find a sentient being anywhere who has not been your mother or your father or your brother or your sister in your past lives. Just think about that, all the people in this room you've been related to in your past lives, most likely. That's how long it is. It's how complex it is. This unfolding of all of these relations and all of this time and all of this space. Everything going on. And we get a sort of picture of ourselves as we're just like a little node. All of these energies moving around. It's kind of coalesced. We're this little node. This little bit of seawater wrapped in a membrane that gets this conceit and decides that I am me. Why? Who cares? If it doesn't care, right? But you can live better. You can choose to do something better. And especially, most especially, those of us who've heard the teachings of the Buddha. And of all of those things that are rare and precious that we've seen, the arising of the Buddha and the teaching of the Buddha is even more rare and precious compared to all of those things. According to the Buddha's teachings, that the Buddha himself is not unique. That it's a bit like the Boltzmann brains things. Like it's incredibly unlikely for a Buddha to appear, but the universe is so big and time is so long that the probability is it happens. And the rising of a Buddha is not because of anything supernatural. It's not because of some prophecy or fate or anything like that. Nothing like that. The rising of the Buddha happens ultimately because there is something about our mind, something about human consciousness, or about consciousness in general, but let's talk about human consciousness. There's something about human consciousness that wants to understand itself, that wants to look back and ask the question, why? Why is it like this? Why do I suffer? Why do I feel happy? Why do people do these things that they're doing? And because we have this curiosity, this wanting to know, most of us don't get that very far. We learn some things in our life. Maybe you learn a little bit of wisdom, a little bit of understanding. And, you know, you see how it is with kids. You know, kids have so much curiosity, always wanting to learn things, always exploring. And as we get older, it's very easy for that curiosity to fade. We lose our interest in learning. We become complacent. We think we've learned enough. So a Buddha is simply someone who keeps on asking. Why? Who's not content with easy answers. And if we look at the stories of the Buddha's practice, the Bodhisattva's practice before his enlightenment, the thing that he was most characteristic of him was that he was relentless. He was completely unsatisfied with any answer that anybody could give him. None of the answers that people were giving him were good enough. He kept on pushing and pushing. He said, why is this? Why do we keep on suffering? Why is it? It's so weird. Right? We get used to it, but it's so weird. Why is it that we are born and all we want to do is be happy? And yet everywhere we are suffering. Why is it that everywhere all we want is to be free? And yet we're in chains. Why is it that all we want to do is to be kind and loving? And yet we find our hearts full of hate. Why is that? And so the Buddha was not content to say, oh, well, that's just how it is. That's just how humans are. No, he wanted to understand. And in the Atadanda Sutta, then he talked about this. He said, looking around at the world, every direction's tossed about. He said that he saw mankind like a fish flopping around in a dried up stream. Why is it like that? Why is there no security or safety anywhere? And then he looked further and he realized it's because of this craving, because of this attachment, because of this conceit, because of this delusion, this ignorance in our own hearts. And it keeps on driving us around from place to place, from life to life. It keeps on driving us around from moment to moment, always looking for something and never finding it. Never being satisfied. And the more we get, somehow it seems, the more dissatisfied we become. And that drive of craving is what keeps all of this going. And so the Buddha said, okay, I'll just take that out, thank you. Just pluck it out. That's it. Very easy. And so the Buddha did this, he achieved it, and he taught us how to do it. When I say very easy, I should qualify. It's both easy and hard. It's very easy in the moment to see and to take out craving for something that you see in that moment. Every little instance of craving is okay. You see that in your meditation. Every time you sit to meditate, something comes up, right? Something that you want, something that you desire, something that you hate or something, and then you can learn to let go of it. And we've all done that in our meditation so many times. It's okay, it's not that hard actually. See something, you want that, and then you relax. A few minutes later, you've forgotten that it was even there. And it's not that hard actually. But the hard thing, of course, is to do it persistently. Have that consistent mindfulness and to consistently undo that craving every moment. So this is what the Buddha did, and this is what the Buddha taught us. So now we are here in this human life, and we don't just have all of these ordinary benefits of the human life. We also have the benefit and the precious gift of hearing the Dhamma. And the Buddha taught us the Four Noble Truths. Yes, there is suffering in life. Suffering is created by our craving and ignorance. We can end it. That's the good news. It's possible to end it, the third noble truth. And there is a path and a practice towards ending it, the Noble Eightfold Path. And that Noble Eightfold Path is things that every single person here can do. The Buddha was he was a challenging teacher. Alright? He wasn't going to accept any excuses. Alright? He was challenging, but he was not a tyrant, and he didn't expect you to do anything that's impossible. Right view, okay? To look into your own views and ideas, to question them, and to be ready to abandon wrong ideas that you have where necessary, and to evolve your understanding. We're all doing that right now. We're improving our right view. You can do it. Right intention, to act out of the sense of letting go, generosity, act out of love and compassion rather than acting out of hate and selfishness and greed. You can all do that. You've all done that in the past. It's not impossible. Right speech. Yeah? To be able to speak in a way that's true and honest and kind and meaningful to help people. Not impossible. We've all done it in the past and we can all do it again. Yeah? Right speech, right action. To refrain from killing, stealing. To live a life where our actions and our deeds don't harm others. it's doable. Right livelihood. Yeah? To make our living in a way that doesn't create harm. Ideally, if we can make our living in a way that actually helps people in a meaningful way. So I'm very lucky, very blessed as a monk to have, make a living by teaching Dhamma and to helping people with their meditation, helping people with the spiritual path. So this is my right livelihood. Yeah? So at the very least, we can avoid a livelihood that's harmful and damaging to people. Right? But hopefully we can do a livelihood that's going to be helpful. Then right effort. Right? That just means trying. It means being able to recognize when something unwholesome is happening in your mind and be able to let go of it. Right mindfulness. We'll practice from right mindfulness when we're doing our meditation, bringing our attention to the breath. And then right samadhi. And samadhi is the outcome of right mindfulness. And if we practice meditation and we let go of the hindrances and defilements, our mind becomes still and peaceful. We've all seen that at least a little bit in our meditation. We've seen a little bit of peace emerging. But that's enough. That maybe not complete, but it's enough for us to understand that this is where that path is going. So this is that right samadhi. So this is the Eightfold Path, the way out of this suffering. And all of those things in the Eightfold Path are clear and straightforward and quite achievable by anybody here. All we need to do is keep taking the next step. And so if we want to make the most out of our precious human life, we want to have gratitude to our parents, gratitude to our families, gratitude to our friends, our neighbours, our people, our country, gratitude to all of the people that have made our life possible, gratitude to the animals and to the environment, gratitude to the whole world for making it possible to us to live this life. And to realize that in this whole universe, as cold and lonely and distant as that universe is, we still have this. We don't know how long we'll have it for. But for now, we have this. And this is our life. And we can make the most of it by being present and being aware of every breath in the moment. So this is my little talk for you for today on preciousness of this human life.